introduce our guest speaker for the month, and that would be Howard G. from Gillette.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
My name is Howard. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Howard.
And certainly in my case, what a case. It's by the grace of a loving God and by the power that I found is the result of the program in the book Alcoholics Anonymous and by the support I get from the members of our wonderful fellowship and by the service that God has blessed me to participate in. I've been separated from alcohol since July 9th, 1983, and I'm very, very grateful for that. And if you knew me while I was drinking, you'd be grateful too. That is without a doubt. I'm delighted to be here. I heard this little story about this couple who were very much in love. And they went to visit their priest. And they walked into the priest's office. And the priest saw how happy they were. They had smiles on their faces. And they said, "Father, we're very much in love, and we would like you to marry us." And the priest says, "Well, I can see that you're in love, and I can see you're very happy, but unfortunately, I will not be able to marry you for the entire period of Lent." And all of a sudden, the smiles on their faces were removed, and there was sadness. And the priest thought for a second to himself and said, "I really hate to disappoint this young couple." And he had a thought. He says, "I'll tell you what, my children." He says, "I will be able to marry you, but you have to make a sacrifice." And they said, "Father, anything, please tell me what." And the priest thought for a second and he said, "You have to refrain from physical intimacy for the entire period of Lent. And they said, "No problem. We can do that. Not a problem whatsoever." And the priest married them, and they were very, very happy. A couple of weeks later, the priest is walking in town, and he sees the young man across the street, and they wave to each other. And out of respect, the young man comes over and says hello to the priest, and he had that smile on his face. And the father said to the young man, "How is everything?" And he said, "Oh, fine, Father, we're just very much in love." And he said, "Well, what about the sacrifice?" And the young man looked at the priest, and all of a sudden his face became very serious. He said, "Father, I'm sorry we didn't make it." So the priest said, "Well, tell me about it." And he says, "Father, one day I was with my wife, and she was wearing one of these mini skirts. And she dropped a can of peas, and when she went down to pick up the peas, the sacrifice was out the window." And the priest looked at him and said, "You know, they will put you out of the church for that." And the young man says, "I thought so. They put us out of the supermarket." Last week, I tried to speak a little bit about steps 3, 4, and 5. And in order for me to come to a place where I even considered turning my will and my life over to the care of God, I had to have evidence that I could no longer do this myself. And after How It Works, there are the three pertinent ideas: that I'm alcoholic and cannot manage my own life. And I can conclude, yeah, I am alcoholic. I realize that before I drink, I have the obsession, that overpowering desire to drink, in spite of the fact that I know I can't drink. And once I ingest the alcohol, I have this other component that only 10% of the people in the United States or the world perhaps have, and that's that craving, that physical factor, that once I ingest the booze, I just can't stop. That probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. And I had to think about that a little bit. And I've gone to doctors, psychiatrists, psychologist. I had my family that tried to help me, friends who tried to help me, and I was beyond human help. And the third pertinent idea is that God could and would if he was sought. And if I would have looked at that third statement without going through the previous chapter, I would have never believed that God would help me, because I grew up in an environment where God was used as a threat. Howard, if you do this, God is going to punish you. Or if you don't do that, God is going to punish you. So I had this idea that God was out to get me. And then when my father passed away, one of the first things I thought about is, he really got me this time. So I believed in God, but I believed he was out to hurt me. And my life reflected that, because it was easier for me to blame God for my travails than take responsibility for my actions. But I found out in the previous chapter that I can do a few simple things and I could begin to have a relationship with God, because that's what I need to have. I need to have a relationship with God. I needed to believe that there was such a thing as a God. And all my life, even though I believed God was a negative force, if somebody would sneeze, I'd say, "God bless you." And I meant that in a good spirit. And if somebody said, "Are you coming there?" I would say, "God willing." Now, I don't know if I did this by habit or what I thought about it, but nonetheless, I would do it. And also to lay aside prejudice. Lay aside old ideas about God, that punishing, judgmental, get even concept that I had of God. Lay that aside. And come up with a conception of God, however inadequate. And I was able to do that. And the conception that I came up with are all the things that I would want in a parent or a best friend, and become willing to believe in my newfound conception. And my book assures me I'm emphatically on my way to this relationship with God and to the beginnings of removing the spiritual malady from my life. Because once I believe that God will do something for me that I'm unable to do for myself, and I make that decision in three to let God do that for me, I'm going to have certain things occur in my life. It is perhaps the first time ever that I began to be somewhat right-sized in realizing that God is, and I'm very limited. I never ever knew that. Of course, when things go your way, or when you feel empowered, you don't think that God is of any use or consequence. So, bearing in mind that I conceded to my innermost self those three pertinent ideas, my book says I'm at step three. And step three is a decision to turn my will, which is my thinking, and that's a good thing, because all action at the conscious level is preceded by thought. So therefore, what I think, I do. And I look back at my life, and I saw my life was a mess, and I realized it was my thinking that created the actions that put me into that mess. So I'm making a decision to turn that thinking over to the care and direction of my new conception of God. That loving, unconditional, non-judgmental, all-powerful, all-knowledge, all-loving creator. And I did that. I made that decision. And my book says, as a result of making that decision, that I have a new employer. And I had to think for a moment. It was a very appropriate terminology, because I had a drinking career. And my drinking career, alcoholic drinking career, lasted 19 years. Being that I have a new employer, I have a new career. And my book says, being all powerful, my new employer will provide what I needed if I kept close to him. And how do I do that? If God dwells within, and I'm convinced that he does, I have to remove those things that separate me from God and perform his work well. Well, what does that mean? Well, I think there are two things. First of all, put nothing else before me and God, and help my fellow man. I think that's a good place to begin. And there are all sorts of wonderful results out of doing that. There is nothing at all in my experience that's negative about making that decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. The only thing that's injurious to me is if I don't. And I said the third step prayer with my sponsor. And we knelt when I said the third step prayer. And I voiced this decision without reservation. Because I have to abandon myself utterly to God, not just the alcohol. And as I continued in this process, I began to see what the utterly was. I made this decision, and my book says that unless I take further action after making my decision, step three could have little permanent effect. And that makes sense to me. Because a decision simply means to make up my mind to do something. I decided to come here tonight. Does that mean I was here? No. It means I made up my mind to come here. In order to bear fruition, I had to take action on that thought. And the action was to get in my car and drive here. And then I got results. The result was I carried out the decision. And it's the same thing with step three. I am making a decision to turn my thinking and my actions over to the care of God. So I need to take some action to carry out that decision. My book says that I need to take an inventory at once. I need to find the things within that are blocking me from God. Liquor was but a symptom. So now I have to get down to causes and conditions. If God dwells inside of me, and I'm convinced that God does, then I don't have far to look. What I have to find out is what is suppressing the sunlight of the Spirit? What is creating that spiritual malady? Why is my life unmanageable sober? Why am I having problem with personal relationships? Why am I a prey to misery and depression? Why do I feel useless? Why? And I'm sober. I needed to find this out. I don't know anybody that's done a four-step drunk. I'm sure there are. So when I did a fourth step, I was sober and I was having these problems. I can't blame the alcohol any longer. The alcohol is not an issue once it's out of my system. So I looked at myself, and my book says when the spiritual malady is overcome, I straighten out mentally and physically. I had a problem with that because to me, I straightened out, I believe, physically before anything else because I gained weight. I was malnutrition when I went into the rehab. I gained weight. I was feeling better physically. But I don't think they mean just how I feel inside. I believe that physical dimension is my relationship to anything of a material or physical nature. And part of that is how I feel inside. Part of that is how I treat other people, how I treat my possessions, or anything that is material. And that took a long time. So my book says when the spiritual malady is overcome, I began to address that when I made that decision to let God direct my thinking. And the book says there are three manifestations of self: resentment, fear, and harms to others. And I needed to look at that. And I inventoried that. And prior to the instructions for each of these three inventories, it says I have to write this down. This is not something I do orally. I mean the inventory now. This is not something I do orally. This is something that I do with pen and paper. And it does make sense, because by definition, an inventory is a written list of items in one's view or possession. It doesn't mean a life story. When a business takes inventory, they don't write their history. They write down what's on the shelf, what's selling, they're going to keep. What's not selling, they're going to get rid of. I need to find out what is not selling in my stock. And I need to find a way to get rid of that. And that's what this process was about for me. And I listed my resentments, top to bottom, the cause, what part of self is affected. And then I found out the most revealing thing that I've ever seen in my life. disregarding what these people did to me, I look for where I was at fault. I never, ever did that in my life. Do you know why? If I needed to look at me, then I might have to change. If I looked at you, I don't have to take responsibility. But I never got well changing anybody, and believe me, I made a career out of that. I did the 10-step long before I came into AA. I continued to take personal inventory and promptly admitted when you were wrong. I took a look at these things. I took a look at my thinking. And I saw that it was my thinking that creates the actions that put me in a position to harm people, to be fearful, and to be resentful. I'm going to repeat that. It was my thinking that created the actions that put me in a position to block God from my life. People weren't blocking me from God. You could tell me whatever you want to tell me. It's what I do with that that determines whether it's going to be injurious or whether I'm going to let it go. Another thing I found out is that it's not so much letting go of things. It's why am I holding on to these things? Because I don't hold on to anything I don't use. As a sick individual who is suffering, these things that blocked me off from God were at one point in my life survival skills. For example, I resented the whole world. I didn't have to look at myself. I feared everything. It kept me doing those things that kept me sick and prevented me from doing things that would get me better. I never ever saw this. It was impossible for me to see these things in my head. And I had my inventory sheets, and I went to my sponsor, and I shared my fifth step. I shared all my life story regarding those things that blocked me off from God. My resentments, my fears, my harms to others. All harms, sexual and non-sexual. I was at a point where I began to see these things were so objectionable to me that I didn't want them any longer. My sponsor says to me, Howard, what I want you to do is I want you to go to a quiet place and I want you to spend an hour. The first half hour, what I would like you to do is be still. And the second half hour, what I would like you to do is go through the first five proposals and ask yourself if you have omitted anything. Do you have a reservation or a lurking notion that someday you'll be able to drink with impunity? Do you believe that God is going to do for you what you can't do for yourself? Have you made a decision to turn everything over utterly? Have you left anything out of your fourth step that may come back someday and hinder you? Have you shared everything in your fifth step with me? And I did that. I spent the first half hour communing with God. And I spent the second half hour looking at those first five proposals. And I asked myself questions. Have you omitted anything? Is your work solid so far? Are these steps properly in place? Have you skimped on anything? Because you can't make mortar without sand. Is it there? And when I answered to my satisfaction, I came back with my sponsor. He asked me those questions, and I said, yes, I could answer to my satisfaction that everything is solid so far. He says, Howard, remember, you are building an arch to which you shall walk a free man at last. You're not going to be dominated by alcohol any longer. He said, are you willing to get rid of these things? These defects that created this action that created your life, are you willing to get rid of these things? I said, yes. He says, are you sure? He says, yeah. I said, yes. He says, well, then you've completed step six. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Even though my book calls them things that are objectionable, Bill likes to use different words. They were objectionable to me. He used a different terminology at the exact right spot. These things became objectionable to me. It wasn't the people that were objectionable to me, although from time to time some people still are. It was the thinking, the defective thinking that created my life that was objectionable to me. And he said, are you ready to ask God to remove these things from your life? And I said, certainly I am. And we got on our knees and I did the 7-step prayer. And we were quiet for some time. And he said to me, this is what I would like you to do. He said, you know by now that if God removes something, something has to take its place. He gave me this terminology that was foreign to me at the time. He said, Howard, nature abhors a vacuum. I looked at this man like he was nuts. I didn't know about no vacuum, no abhorring. You know what I'm saying? I said, oh yeah? He said, if God removes something from you and there's an empty space in your head, something has got to fill it in. That made sense to me. Because I had tried this when I was newly sober. I had tried this process. And I did my 6th and 7th step. And my sponsor at that time says, well, you're done. That's it. And 3 weeks later, I got a tap on the shoulder after I left ShopRite in Millburn. And the guy says, I saw what you put in your pants. Because I had lifted something, I'm ashamed to say. And you know, one of my first thoughts was, what happened to 6 and 7? What's with this program? These are the steps I took, not God. I think God is doing all right without 6 and 7. He says, Howard, he says, this is what I would like you to do. He says, I would like you to write a list of the things you find objectionable and put them on one side of the paper. And I had those 5 character defects that step 4 talks about, and I had a 7 deadly sins. I must have had, I don't know, about 15 defects of character. And he said, on the other side of the piece of paper, he says, I would like you to write down the things that you would like God to replace these with. And I did. And ironically, it was the opposite of what I didn't want any longer. And he said, let's say the 7-step prayer. And he said, at the same time, he said, after we say the prayer, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to ask God to remove the defect and give you the strength to replace it with the asset. Do you think you could do that? And I said, yes. So for the longest time, as part of my morning discipline, after I said my 3rd-step prayer and my 7th-step prayer, I would say something like this. Dear God, please take away my selfishness and help me to be unselfish. Dear God, please take away my dishonesty and help me to be honest. And I did this with all my character defects. And then after about a week or so, I says, how much longer do I have to do this? And he said, until you see some changes in your life. And I never asked him again how long I would have to do this. Over a period of years, I developed a series of mental habits, things that I used over and over and over again because they worked for me. For example, somebody would ask me a question and I'd lie. Did you do this? No. Are you drinking too much? No. Did you leave the lights on? No. I developed a habit of coming up with excuses that after a period of time I bought into. Like any other habit, a physical habit, biting your nails, picking your cuticles, flipping your hair. I lost that a while ago. In order for me to break a habit, I have to work against the habit. If I'm going to feed into the habit, then I'm going to continue to exhibit whatever it is that habit manifests itself in. So he said, Howard, He says, you got to stop doing what you want to do. I said, okay. He says, when a negative thought or a destructive thought comes into your thinking, do not feed into it. He said, there's a little period of time, I call it a window, between the thought and the action, between the desire and the reality. There's a little bit of time. He says, in order for a thought to become a reality, I have to lend action to it. And that made a lot of sense to me. When a negative thought would come into my head, I would train myself not to act on that. And the first thing I would do is I would say, Dear God, please take this from me. Now, this didn't happen overnight. Habits don't change overnight. I had to really work at this. I think the 12 steps says something about practicing. I had to practice this. And then he says, when you're willing not to do the things you want to do, you got to be willing to do those things that you don't want to do. Like tell the truth when you don't want to tell the truth. Like be considerate of other people's feelings when you don't want to be considerate of other people's feelings. Like act on courage when you would rather use fear as an excuse. And he says, if you continue to do this, if you don't do what you want to do, and begin to do those things that you don't want to do, before long, you're going to make changes. He said, you're going to change your stock in trade. The analogy that our book gives. Old ideas, these negative ideas, are going to be cast to one side. And this new set of motives are going to begin to dominate your thinking. And you're going to change your stock and trade. And you're going to become a different person. There's not much information on steps 6 and 7 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. A friend of mine says 6 and 7 are like the pick and shovel steps. He says, when you go into the hardware store to buy a pick or a shovel, you don't get a set of directions, but you're prepared for backbreaking work. The first 5 steps put me in a position to become willing to change because I saw the destructiveness of my life. 6 and 7 to me are really changing steps. Anytime I don't do what I want to do, and I begin to do those things that I really don't want to do, that creates change. Because if I continue to do those things that I did, I'm going to continue to get what I got. And I know what I got, and I don't want what I got. So I got to be doing something else. There's a wise man who said 2 profound things, at least to me. The first thing is that successful daily living requires dying. In order for me to live someplace new, I got to die someplace old. In order for me to live in honesty, I have to die in dishonesty. In order for me to live unselfish, I have to die in selfishness. And that made a lot of sense to me. And this very wise man also said that they are transformed, change, by the renewing of their minds, by the spiritual changing of their thinking. And I said, wow, this stuff was written thousands of years ago, and it makes sense for me today. In order for me to change, I have to change my thinking. But if I could change my thinking on my own, I would have never been put in this situation. It's like when you burn your hand a couple of times, you're careful around hot things. In my particular case, I continue to lie, and I always felt terrible about lying, but it was the lesser of 2 evils. I felt guilty, but it was better than taking responsibility. I had to be willing to change that. And there's only one thing that made me willing, and that's the pain and humiliation and degradation of a life run on self-will. As I began to practice these steps on a daily basis, I began to see that I responded to people differently rather than react to them. And also, people started to make comments about me that were positive. And for an egomaniac with an inferiority complex, when somebody starts to compliment me, that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. So I got positive reinforcement, not only from the fellowship, but friends outside of this fellowship and family. This was a wonderful growth opportunity for me to do. And I'm very, very blessed that I had direction on how to do it. I think that as an alcoholic, I'm one of the most blessed people in the world. Because of my alcoholism, I came into a fellowship, and within this fellowship, you presented me with a program. And when I applied these principles up until this point into my life, I changed. I know many people with spiritual maladies. I'm one of 9 children. See, Gene, I came from a dysfunctional neighborhood. And I learned most of my information on a street corner. I'm one of 9 children. And as far as I know, I'm the only alcoholic. But my other siblings are resentful. They're fearful. And they continue to harm each other. My mother used to say, you're putting 2 ends against the middle. And they're good at that. One against the other. Now, when you're spiritually sane, you don't do those sort of things. And these people are not alcoholic, and because they're not alcoholic, they don't seek a spiritual remedy, because what they know is all they think they know. They don't know anything else. And because of my condition, our book says you're catapulted. Now, it doesn't say we ease it. Yeah. It uses the word launched, catapulted. I mean, these are incredible words when you think about it. I'm grateful I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful that I had this condition which required help. What I'm sad is that there are many people who have this condition who are sick. And what makes me even sadder is that many of them are in our fellowship. That's what really saddens me. I think that's a tragedy. But with groups like this and other groups that are springing about, maybe we can carry the message and therefore people will have an awakening sufficient to recover. I said, are we done? He says, no. Now, mind you, my fifth step was about, I'd say, almost 3 hours. I took the hour, and then we're back into this, so now we're into almost 5 hours now. And he said there's another dimension that you have to get right with. I said, oh? He says, now we're going to look at the physical dimension. He says, 4 through 7, we look at the mental dimension. 8 and 9, we're going to look at the physical dimension. My relationship to the world and its people. We need to take a look at that. He says, I know we've done a lot of work, and I know you're clearing away some wreckage. But he said, you need to clear away the guilt and remorse and the fear associated with these harms. He says, remember, you decided to abandon yourself utterly to God. This is all part of the utterly. He says, we need to write a list of the people to whom you harmed. And he said, we're going to take it from the first column of your fourth step. And I had 28 names on my resentment inventory. I can't remember how many I had on my fear or my harms, but it was significant. And he said, you're going to take the name off of that first column that you believe you owe an amend to. And I did. And I can't remember how many I had, but there was quite a bit. It was a yellow tablet, the legal, and it was filled. And, you know, he always said, do you think you could do this? You know, I mean, like he gave me a choice. Like, you're probably alcoholic. Do you think you could do this? So I wanted to clear away this wreckage because I knew it was blocking me. And I knew I didn't want to be blocked any longer. So I wrote down my list. And he says, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to take this list and I would like you to divide it into four lists. The amends you're going to make now, later, maybe, never. And he said, on the never list, I want you to put down the names of the people who you think you might injure if you made amends to them. And he smiled, because he knew. He knew he's done this before. And as a person who has done it with other people before, there are a lot of nevers with people that you don't want to go to, but who you need to go to. Anyway, I took that list and I wrote down the four lists and I wrote down the names. And I started off with my family. And I'll never forget, one amend that I made was to my sister. We were driving to my parents' cemetery in Cypress Hills, Queens. And we're on, Queens Boulevard, correct. We were on Queens Boulevard, and I was driving, and I made the approach to my sister. And she looked at me, and I was looking ahead of me, but I could see out of askance, out of the corner of my eye. And she says, you know, Mother said a leopard never changes its spots, and I don't see any changes in you. So don't be making any amends to me because you told me you were sorry over and over and over again. And I was mortified. I have to tell you that, I mean, like, I didn't know what to say. And there's a part of me, the Brooklyn part of me, wanted to lash out at this poor girl. And then for sure, she would have been correct. So I didn't. So I had a few amends where people really ripped into me. Step 9 is a pretty definitive step. Made direct amends to such people, wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. So it tells me what kind of amend I have to make, which is direct, face to face. And it tells me when to make it, wherever possible. Not whenever, but wherever. And it tells me when not to make it, except when to do so would injure them or others. So this step is pretty definitive in itself. And why do I need to make a direct amend? Well, I can call somebody, but the chances are I didn't hurt them on the phone. I could write a letter to somebody, and the chances are I didn't hurt them in a letter. The chances are that I hurt the individual face to face some way, or maybe spoke about him behind his back or her back, that sort of thing. Another thing is that if I don't go face to face, I will never know how that person received the amend. I will never know what his reaction might be if I see him again. For instance, if I write somebody a letter, or if I speak to somebody on the phone, it's really not doing my utmost, unless that's the only way I can do it because they're cross country or something like that. But if I make a face-to-face direct amend with somebody, and I've done my utmost, how you receive it is your business. I know that I'm cleaning off my side of the street and I'm not sweeping it onto somebody else's side. You follow what I mean? I know that I'm doing my utmost. I know that I'm not being critical of the individual that I'm going to make the amend. And that was important for me to hear because there were some amends that I did have to write letters to. Two of them were my parents. My parents were deceased. My father died when I was 14. And my mother died when I was 26. I treated my father after he was dead in a fashion that for many years I was ashamed of. When we would gather together at family dinners, especially this time of year, and the name, my father's name, come up, either I would say something very derogatory or I'd have to leave the room. I was really angry at him for dying when I was so young. I thought he left me. I used that resentment against my father from the age of 14 till the age of 38. That's 24 years. I used that resentment against my father. Very much like that woman in back of the book. I fanned, I fed, I nurtured it as one might a delicate child. That's taken good care of this resentment. I don't hold on to anything I don't use. So the question is, how did I use it? It gave me excuses for my lack of education, my inadequacies, my relationship failures, and my alcoholism. That was very important to me, that resentment. You follow what I'm saying? When my father's name came up, I made sure you knew that I was ticked off at him, that he had left me. And don't be talking to me about my lifestyle. That's why. Transfer blame, the purpose of resentment. When I saw it on paper in my fourth step and shared it in my fifth step, I was free of that. It was like a cleansing. And I wrote my father a letter. I didn't get many personal things after my father died. But one of the things that I got was his Parker pen. And the man always used green ink. I still have it. It was a green pen with a gold cap and that thin Parker spear. Yeah. Right, Georgie? And No, it wasn't two hearts, man. It was like almost like at the end of an arrow, feathers. I went out, you know what I'm talking about. I went out and I bought green ink. And I filled that sucker up with green ink, and I wrote my father a letter. And I shared with him what I did with that resentment that I had for him. And there's really no way that I could make that up to the man. He's dead and buried. God rest his soul. But I'm one of nine kids. I think I'm the only one that takes care of his cemetery plot in Cypress Hills. And I'm happy to take care of it. And I'm delighted when I leave there and everything is in place. And you know, if I say it's in place, my man, it's in place. There's not one piece of ivory that's out. You get my drift? That makes me feel good. That's the way I carry out my amend with him. I did the same thing with my mother. Now, let me tell you what a misdirected amend will do. I was in the rehab for 9 weeks, and I was getting sober, free of alcohol, for 9 weeks. And after a period of time, I became very lonely for the opposite sex. And before I went into the hospital, the rehab, I had broken up with my girlfriend of 11 years. The way we broke up, she had taken me out for a beautiful Saturday. We went to a gym, a club, on like the 40th floor of a building on 3rd Avenue and 87th Street. And they had a pool, and they had workout. I used to watch those people work out and lose weight. And on the outside, they had like a terrace, and it had, I'll never forget this, a green indoor-outdoor carpeting with chaise lounge. It was really nice. We had a beautiful day. And we're walking home, and we pass this stand on Lexington Avenue and 86th Street, and she wants to get orange juice, and was freshly squeezed, and it was a... And I was annoyed that she wanted it. This woman probably spent $100 on us. And I was really ticked off that she wanted a glass. I said to myself, you can buy a container for $1.50. You know what I mean? I didn't say anything. I was good like that. Anyway, we go back to the house there, And she's in the shower. And I flipped. And I gathered whatever I could in my luggage, which was a hefty bag. And I wrote her a note. And I told her the jig was up in so many words. After 11 years, this is how I ended a relationship with a woman who took me in off the street. I had nothing. And she took me in off the street. I mean, I thought nothing of it. I didn't think of her at all. The only thing I thought about is I got to get out of here. Terrible thing. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root, the inherent characteristic of my problem. So anyway, while I was in the rehab, I got a hold of a 12 and 12. It's the first thing I stole. So I was in this rehab for about, I must have been about 4 weeks, and they put me off on a different unit. I had my own room. It was two beds, but I was the only one in there with a private bathroom and a little refrigerator. And in between the beds was a 12 and 12. I got to tell you what a sick mind I had. I went out to the nurse's station, and I said, "Can you give me a label?" She looked at me, you know, like a mailing label. Yeah. I said, I just want to put my name on something. And what I did is I took that label and I put it over that other person's name and I wrote my name. I still have it. Anyway, I saw this deal about making amends. And I said, I got to make an amend to Molly. And I got discharged from the rehab and I called her. See, I wasn't looking to right the wrong. That's what an amend is for. Amend means to revise or change for the better. I wasn't looking to right the wrong. I was looking to snuggle. That's not the purpose of an amend. And I called this woman, and I was nervous, and I called her. Oh, she annoyed with me. She says, "I can't talk to you. I'm sitting next to my fiancé." God is my judge. I'll never forget this. I was crushed again because in my head, I'm trying to do the right thing. I'm trying to apologize. But that wasn't the... See, I thought with a different head. You understand what I mean? That wasn't the right thing to do. A misguided step. Well, my book really talks... My other book talks about a misguided inventory leads to grandiosity, guilt, and the blaming of others. This was a misguided eighth and ninth step because I was trying to write the relationship for very selfish reasons. Let me tell you what happened with this. 1985, I remember this because I remember the car I had. I had a little white Honda Prelude. It was sweet. I call her up, and you know, my demeanor, I don't know what was different, but I called her up. I had come from a weekend in Pompano, and my agenda was different. I learned a little bit about this program. And I called her up and I said, "You know, I'd like to meet with you. Can we have dinner?" And she said, "Yes." And I had no thought other than right and the wrong. It was a beautiful thing. Anyway, it was the summertime. I was tanned up. I was feeling good. I had a new car. You know, I'd arrived, baby. You know, I'm feeling good. We go out to dinner and I make my approach and I share with her. And you know, the tears were coming out of her eyes. And you could see the relief in her face. And I said to her, "Molly, honey..." I don't think I said honey. Take that back. I said, "Molly," I said, "if there's anything else I did that you would like to talk to me about, now's the time." And you know what she said to me? She says, "Howard, I did some things to you too." I said, "I appreciate that, but you know that's not what this is about." At any rate, we had dinner, we finished dinner, I drove her home, I said goodnight to her, and that Christmas, I sent her, I sent her a New Year's card, and I never heard from her again, and she never heard from me again, and I was complete. I did my utmost, I right the wrong, I did terrible things to this woman that I can never take back, but I'm okay with it. That's the purpose for me of making an amend. Sure, I would like to please the other person, but I don't know that that's the purpose of this. I need to get right with me. My book says that I need to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. It doesn't tell me I got to be of maximum service to God. It doesn't say that. It says I got to fit myself. Through these first 9 steps, I'm beginning to fit myself back into the design for life that God created for me to begin with. That's thousands of years old. Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy soul, 1, 2, and 3, and all thy mind, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And love thy neighbor as thyself, 8 and 9. I have been fit back into that design. On page 25, my book says, almost none of us like the self-searching, 4, the leveling of our pride, 6 through 9, and confession of shortcomings, 5, which the process requires for its successful consummation. The successful consummation of that process, and a process by definition is a series of actions or steps taken in a specific order, which bring about a desired result, the desired result of the first 9 steps, the consummation of that process, are the 12 promises on page 83 and 84. I know a new freedom and a new happiness. Freedom. I can go anywhere that I want to go. I don't have to be afraid to go to a restaurant because there's a bar. I don't have to be paranoid that I'm going to watch a program and there may be a beer commercial. I don't have to go out to eat with somebody and watch somebody else drink. I've heard people who are years and years sober say they went out to dinner with their wife or their girlfriend and they're counting the drinks on the tables around them. How selfish is that? If I'm preoccupied with things outside of me, am I there for my company? That's being selfish. That's the root of my problem that was, and from time to time still is. No longer. I don't want to be that way any longer. I have a new employer. Being all powerful, he provided what I needed. He removed the obsession from me. I tried to do that for many years. I could never, ever do it. An obsession is an idea that's so powerful that it overcomes the truth and allows me to believe the lie. Through the first 9 steps, that obsession has been removed. There's an empty space in my head. Nature pours a vacuum. Something's got to fill it. In my case, it was the obsession to stay sober, no matter what. It may mean to remove myself from people that I love, family members. I do. It may mean I don't go to certain situations. Not because I'm afraid to be there, but because I don't want to be there. I don't want to see people make fools out of themselves by drinking. I don't want to, it hurts me to see somebody who I love, who's a nice person, and once they drink, they start slurring and making a fool of themselves. I don't want to be there any longer. I don't have to be there any longer. These first 9 steps in the program Alcoholics Anonymous have made me a different individual. In my distress, I cried out to the Lord and he heard me. That's what I did when I admitted my first step in Brooklyn, New York. I didn't know that. But I said, "Dear God, either take me out of this or show me the way." He heard me. At the 9th step, I'm becoming fit to be of maximum service. You ever notice that if you're not right in your head, you could be at a meeting and you could hear people talking about difficulties in their life, and instead of going over to try and share your experience, you say to myself, "What the hell am I going to do? I have nothing to give this person anyway." God provided you to be of maximum service, but you weren't fit to carry it out, right? God always provides me with opportunities to be of maximum service. The idea is, do I take advantage of them based on my spiritual condition? So I got to be fit. The The first 9 steps have enabled me to be fit. I see God as the master puzzle maker. And there's millions and billions of pieces in this puzzle. And I have to get my piece of the puzzle to fit in to that mosaic or that design of living that He created for me. This has been a hell of a journey. And I got to tell you, I'm feeling good. I'll never drink again. I could stop here. You're going to have to wait until next week to find out if I could stop here. This has been a glorious, glorious journey. My book says that God wants me to be happy, joyous, and free, and that I create my own misery. My book also says I have a self-imposed illness, and I have self-imposed misery. The only thing that helped me with my self-imposed illness was God. The only thing that can help me with my self-imposed illness is to be willing to go to God to see the truth about that illness and have it be removed. God bless you. Have a beautiful week. And I look forward to see some of you as I trudge this road of happy destiny. We'll close.